I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is author, conservationist, and activist Terry Tempest Williams. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Terry Tempest Williams. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming to the JCC of San Francisco. I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs here. And it is such an honor to have Terry Tempest Williams, called a citizen writer, a writer who speaks and speaks out eloquently on behalf of an ethical stance towards life. A naturalist and fierce advocate for freedom of speech, she has consistently shown us how environmental issues are social issues that ultimately become matters of justice. She is an award-winning author of 15 books, including the book we're here to celebrate tonight, this beautiful meditation on America's national parks. The book celebrates the centennial of the National Park Service with thought-provoking, lyrical portraits on a dozen of our parks, including Alcatraz Island. And before Terry speaks, I'd like to welcome Greg Moore, President and CEO of the Golden Gate National Parks Conservancy, to say a few words about that. So, Greg?
Good evening, everyone, and what an honor it is to be with people who care about our national parks and our public lands. And in the Bay Area, we are so blessed to have national park sites all around us that we enjoy every day. For someone who grew up traveling to national parks and began my career as a national park ranger, the idea of being on a stage welcoming Terry Tempest Williams to speak is just awe-inspiring to me. When I learned that she had included Alcatraz in her book for the National Park Centennial, I was amazed by the courage of that choice. Not many people, when they think of National Park, think of Alcatraz. They think of the Tetons, or Yellowstone, or Yosemite. Not remembering that the mission of our National Park system is not just to preserve the proudest moments of American history, but the moments that cause us to reflect upon issues of justice, of civil liberties, of freedom of expression, and the very themes that Ai Weiwei brought to Alcatraz in his exhibition just about 2 years ago. Terry found her way to the Alcatraz dock, waiting in line like every other tourist, hoping to get a ticket to go see the Ai Weiwei exhibition, and I think got about the last two tickets out there. If only she would have known, she could have just called me and I could have saved her all the trouble. But anyway, to have my personal life and my professional life connect in such a wonderful way with Terry's writing so central to both, and her inspiration so powerful to me, I know we're in for an incredibly special treat this evening to hear her reflect on our national parks, their 100 years, and their meanings in our lives. So please welcome Terry Tempest Williams.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Jordan. It's such an honor to be here with you tonight at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco. And I hope you know how much this means to me. This community has always been a place of freedom to me. It has been an intellectual and spiritual ecotone. And I count my blessings with each of you. And too many to name, and I can't quite see you. But you're filled with all the people I love in the universe here in the Bay Area, so I thank you for being here. And I have a few more acknowledgments, and the first one and the central one is Frisch Brandt. Many of you know Frisch as the president of the Frankel Gallery. I met her 3 years ago through a mutual friend, Stephen Barclay, and when we were talking about this idea of a book about national parks, he said, "You have to meet Frisch." We met, It was magic. And I met a woman with such vision of mind and spirit that my idea of our national parks completely were turned inside out and upside down. Where I had been thinking more of a traditional way of looking at our parks, Frisch reminded me through photographs that it's not about documentation. It's not even about illustration, but it's about an evocation, an invocation of the emotional landscape that our national parks command. And it made all the difference. And what I want you to know is that San Francisco plays large in this book because of the photographs. Carlton Watkins, Lee Friedlander, Lucas Felsman, Christina Seely, Ansley Rivers West, just some of the photographers that have ties in the Bay Area. This morning I was reading I Am Not I by Jacob Needleman, one of your community members in Oakland. And this poem struck me by Juan Ramon Jimenez. I am not I. I am this one that walks by my side without me seeing him, the one I sometimes go to see and who sometimes I forget, the one who is silent, serene when I am talking, the one who forgives, sweet when I hate, the one who goes where I am not, the one who will remain standing when I die. As I read this, I couldn't help but read it as the land, wild nature, even our own, inseparable, the one I sometimes go to see and who sometimes I forget, the land, the one who is silent, serene, the one who forgives sweet when I hate, the land, the one who goes where I am not, the one who will remain standing when I die, the land. And I want to share with you, because this is really the first time I've been reading from this in a full way, it was my intention and Frisch that this book, it has a belly band, but like us, it is temporary, and that what remains is the land, Yosemite, Grand Teton, Great Smoky, Arches, Canyonlands, these beautiful wild parks that will survive us. And so I love that the book mirrors the essence of these ideas. I will be personal with you tonight. It's been a year for me of confronting illusions. It's no longer whether or not climate change is real, but for me, for Brooke, how shall we live? It's no longer we're heading down the river and we're going to hit those rapids called climate change. From my point of view, we are over the cliff in a free fall. How shall we live? This year, Brooke and I visited the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which I hope that President Obama will see his way to establish a monument. I've been thinking of a triple crown with Arctic National Monument, as well as Bears Ears National Monument and Maine's North Woods. We went and spent time in Kaktovik, which is the Inupiaq village, as you know, adjacent to the refuge. This is what I saw in the village of Kaktovik. Painted houses on the edge of the sea, boats, trucks, snow machines, men, women, and children, sled dogs chained to stakes waiting for snow, caribou skins, wolverine skins, geese, a boneyard of bowhead whale skulls, vertebrae and ribs, great white bears swimming to shore, great white bears walking toward the boneyard, great white bears standing among bones, licking bones, becoming bones. This is what I saw outside the village of Kaktovik. A snowy owl standing on a tussock, draped in fog, yellow eyes burning, and when the fog lifted, a forest of large white crosses of Inupiaq elders standing behind the owl. And behind them, a line of light, the Brooks Range. It was not a mirage. This is what I remember from the village of Kaktovik. Three gunshots heard at night is a warning. Polar bear is in the village. Three gunshots heard at night, Polar Bear is in the village walking. 3 gunshots heard at night, and I remember standing up looking out the window. In Kaktovik, I met a woman named Marie. Marie was dancing in the village, twirling, twirling, twirling. In the middle of the road, she was twirling. She fell down. I stopped. I helped her back up. I asked her if she was all right. She started twirling again, fell again, got up, and said, "My world is now spinning. My family's fish camp has fallen in the sea. My elders have only memory of fish camp passed on to me. I don't know who I am anymore." There is no sanctuary from the rising seas or the warming earth, only the refuge of our own making. And this from the Galapagos National Park in Ecuador. And I shared these two experiences, north and south, because not only are our national parks here in the United States, but now, as you know, it is a global idea that finds its roots here. Time, the evolution of time in the Galapagos, a time of unexpected interludes, incantatory moments with fellow species who live somewhere on the edge of an evolving planet, witnessed. Beauty is the origin of wonder. I want to follow. I want to follow what I can never understand, a love that is wild. We are here because of love. Cradled in the boat with a lullaby of stars, I am being rocked to sleep, following thoughts. Creation is not an act, but a process. What is the process? Has anyone been face to face with evolution? Today, I was eye to eye with a Galapagos tortoise who spent 3 months walking from the top of the volcano down to the sea to lay her eggs at night on the island of Isabella. In the slow, deliberate nature of her world, she upholds 12 million years of perfection. What enables her to live 18 months without food or water? Does a fast predicated by drought or famine become spiritual? What can we do for the tortoise? Step to the side. Give her the right of way. Kneel. Wally Stegner, whom we all love, is well known for saying that our national parks are our best idea. I would argue that our national parks and monuments are an evolving idea. Our national parks are breathing spaces in a world that is increasingly holding its breath. When the eminent biologist E.O. Wilson calls for half the earth to remain wild if we are to survive and thrive as a species, what is that going to require for us to live with the winged ones, the scaled ones, the pod, the fin, the four-legged, six-legged, eight-legged, and rooted ones, and all other forms of life on this beautiful planet we call home? What will be required? An open heart, an altruism that is extended beyond our own species, a fierce attention to a politics of place, often uncomfortable, courage, action, a love that is wild, community. The community that is gathered here tonight. Whenever I enter a national park, I meet the miraculous and the sublime. It is the place of poetry. When the pot lid of night slides into place, when the frogs shout their one word, love, me, 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 when the stars and the moon get down the business feigning serenity, and the nighthawks make good on their name, you and I will be in bed. Tangled as we are meant to be, the improbable geese on the other side of the ceiling, flying south against all odds. It is not enough to love the world. We must dive in. When I was young, says the poet Charles Finn, I used to go out at night and howl at the moon just for practice, just for kicks. And just in case it came to that, look around, the moonlight taught me. Everything conspires to love. Love, Again, we are here because of love. A love that is wild. Wildness, with or without us. One species among many. We are storytellers. When I started out with this book, I thought, hooray, finally this is a book that will be easy. Finally, this is a book that will be joyous only. And immediately I realized how wrong I was. Never, and I just turned 60, have I chosen to tackle a book so complex with both shadow and light. I had to ask myself, by what authority do I even write this book? I am not a historian. I am not a scientist. I certainly am not an expert in public policy. And I had to face the fact that this would be a book I would be writing out of my limitations. It's an attempt. And what I finally realized is, whatever authority I have, it is as a visitor. It is as a storyteller. It is as one who grew up in Utah, where we believed that Zion, Bryce, Capitol Reef, Arches, and Canyonlands were our home ground. It's amazing looking at California. My father always told us, I was born here, and when we would come back every year to Capistrano, just like the swallows, my father would always say, pay attention to California. What happens in California will catch on to the rest of the country. It happens here first. I think that's true. And I love that California, your home ground, has the most national parks and monuments of anywhere in the country. Utah is third. That was interesting to me. Channel Islands, Death Valley, Joshua Tree, Kings Canyon, Lassen Volcanic, Redwood, Sequoia, Yosemite, Pinnacles, the most recent. And three new monuments, Mojave Trails, Sand to Snow, and Castle Mountains. I hope the rest of the country follows suit. I hope there are more monuments before President Obama leaves, and I hope there are more national parks in our lifetime and that they continue, that it's a dynamic process. 265 million acres of land and water, preserved, protected by President Obama. He is now the most conservation-minded president in our history, more than Teddy Roosevelt. Isn't that amazing? Natural history's stories, our national parks, our stories. Never one story, but multiple stories. What I can tell you tonight is that my stories are rooted in the American West, that where I come from in the state of Utah, it is both a physical landscape, a political landscape, and a spiritual one. But most importantly, it is where erosion occurs, where nothing is as it appears. And I can't count the times when people have come to visit us and they said, there is nothing here. I think what that means is I don't have the eyes to see a world that is not green. And I think my favorite story is a friend came to visit us. She has a very high-powered life in New York. She is a television producer for CBS. She said she always wanted to come to the desert. She lasted less than 24 hours. And I'll never forget, we got up. I was going to make her coffee. You know, we were going to have this wonderful time on the porch looking out at this red rock desert where canyon walls rise upward like praying hands. And she said, Terry, I'm so sorry, but I've packed my bags. Can you take me back? And I said, I'm so sorry. Did I offend you? And she said, aren't you afraid you're going to be forgotten? And I thought, no, it does not cross my mind. I think this is what the land teaches us. We will be forgotten. And that is terrifying to some.
You're listening to author, conservationist, and activist Terry Tempest Williams, whose latest book is The Hour of Land, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
In the centennial year of our beloved national parks, there is much to celebrate and protect in the political climate of today. And I'm always searching for wise words, and I found them readily in Bernard DeVoto, who writes on America's public lands in 1951, Harper's Magazine. Tell me if this doesn't sound familiar. You had better watch this now and from now on. The land grabbers are on the loose again, and they can be stopped only as they were before, by the effective marshaling of public opinion. This was 1951. Today is 2016. It's the same story, only I would argue the stakes are higher. And I love these words of Wallace Stegner in the same era, written as the Bureau of Reclamation was not only considering but planning to construct the hydroelectric dam at Echo Park that would inhibit Yampa and Green Rivers in Dinosaur National Monument. We all know this story. But again, his words, let me read them. 1955. It is a better world with some buffalo left in it. A richer world with some gorgeous canyons unmarred by signboards, hot dog stands, superhighways, or high-tension lines, undrowned by power or irrigation reservoirs. If we preserved as parks only those places that have no economic possibilities, we would have no parks. And in the decades to come, it will not be only the buffalo and the trumpeter swan who need sanctuaries. Our own species is going to need them too. It needs them now. Stegner. The dam was never built, and today, 6 decades later, Dinosaur National Monument remains an oasis of calm, home to Fremont people. 1,000 years ago, home to Ute people who live there now, adjacent to the oil and gas boom currently underway in the Uinta Basin. Here's what I found. And it's the story that no one wants to hear. But 40 of our national parks in America are threatened by oil and gas development. 12 of our national parks and monuments already have oil and gas development in them, with another 30 national parks pending. As we mark the centennial of the National Park Service in the United States of America, my question is this: what is the relevance of our national parks in the 21st century? And how might these public commons bring us back home to a United States of humility? Another question. Where is our restraint, our reverence, our respect? So I thought I was writing a book about national parks. What I have realized is I have written a book about America, and I have fallen in love with her again. Greg asked me why these 12 national parks. There's 406 national park units, maybe 408. Here's how I decided. There are those parks that are skin to me. I can't imagine my life without them. Grand Teton National Park, Canyonlands National Park, migratory routes for my family and me, north and south, the Colorado Plateau, the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. There are those parks that I was familiar with, but I wanted to move into them in a deeper way. Theodore Roosevelt National Park in North Dakota, Acadia National Park in Maine. There were those national parks that I dreamed of seeing. Big Bend National Park. And if I ever disappear, that's where you will find me. Gates of the Arctic National Park. Above the Arctic Circle, the least visited national park in the system. There were those that I went to on assignment as a journalist, Gulf Coast, National Seashore, in Louisiana, Florida, and Alabama during the BP oil spill. And there were those whose history haunted me. Alcatraz, Gettysburg, Cesar Chavez National Monument. I talked about the idea of our national parks as part of our evolution as a people. Not only our best idea, but an evolving idea. And I think Alcatraz is a beautiful example of that, specifically bringing in Ai Weiwei as a political prisoner in a place where it wasn't about who escaped prison, but who is still in prison. And to see that with Tim DeChristopher as a felon, I thought I knew his story. He shared so little of it. But when we went into Alcatraz with that exhibit and political prisoners, their faces made out of Legos, his story unfolded, and for 6 to 7 hours, he never stopped telling stories. Our national parks are places of healing. In Gettysburg, I, in my ignorance, thought it was the war that belonged to the South, to the North, the Union, the Confederacy. What I came to realize is that this war was fought for us as Westerners, of whether or not there would be slaves. What I learned is that you can go to Gettysburg National Battlefield and never hear the word slavery until just recently. Who benefits from not telling the full story? And what I also learned in talking to 2 reenactors for the Confederates, artillerymen, when I asked them what was the cause of the Civil War, in all sincerity and seriousness, one of them said, "If you think I'm going to say it's about slavery, you're not going to hear it from me. It's states' rights. It's our sovereignty. It's getting the government out of our lives. Slaves, guns, it's the same story, just different items." Chilling. The rhetoric that I hear in the American West, Utah, Malheur, the war has never ended. I want to pay tribute tonight to Marion Weber. Marion, thank you for the generosity of your family, for Lawrence Rockefeller, your father, for your grandfather, John D. Rockefeller Jr. What I love is that in your family, protecting these lands, somewhere I imagine that there might have been a conversation between your father and grandfather, that when Lawrence said, "Couldn't we save this ranch for our family?" your grandfather may have said, "For a time, and then let it return to the American people." And your father in his 90s made that vow, a promise kept. And what I can thank you is what your father returned was my father's gain. And all those years that we were able to see those beautiful cabins, never imagining that one day we could be privy to that land as well. That the privilege of one family became the privilege of another. And I thank you for that. And I want to share this passage from the chapter on Grand Teton in honor of you and your father and siblings. On my father's 80th birthday, we saw a bear, a grizzly standing upright. We had just hiked to Grandview Point in Grand Teton National Park, where Emma Matilda Lake and Tuwash Ocean Lake appear below. And if you turn around, the glory of the Teton Range looms behind you. We were a party of 4 generations, the youngest just 1 year old, and we were resting at the base of the trail when the grizzly appeared. Instead of being afraid, we stood as the bear did, trying to get a better look at the elusive beast. The bear bolted into the woods. Gone. My niece smiled and looked to her grandfather. Happy birthday, John. Maybe that says something about our family. Not long ago, my father and I were hiking to Taggart Lake, a short, lovely walk to the base of the Tetons. As we walked up the trail, we heard a horn blow repeatedly. Around the bend, a man in a Harvard sweatshirt, half crazed with fear, was holding a bear horn out in front of him, pressing the button every 15 seconds or so. A large canister of bear spray hung low from his belt, and numerous bear bells dangled from his backpack. He looked like a one-man marching band. The expression on his face when he met us, head-on, was one of sheer terror. "Good God," my father said, "you look like you belong in the circus, not in the Tetons. I've been hiking this trail for 70 years and never seen a bear on it yet. Cut the horn." I forget what the hiker said in response, but I do recall my father's parting comment. "If I were you, I wouldn't advertise where you went to school." This was the kind of impatience and candor I was raised with, in spite of the grace of my mother and grandmothers. The scales of nature will always seek equilibrium. Even a feather can tip the balance. The Lawrence S. Rockefeller Preserve was dedicated on June 21st, 2008. Mr. Rockefeller's daughter, Lucy Rockefeller Waletsky, said, "My father recognized mind, body, spirit as one word." My own father was among the first visitors in the Grand Teton National Park to see the eastern shore of Phelps Lake when it was finally opened to the public. As a man who has walked most of the trails in the Tetons, he walked the newly marked trail in awe, never imagining that this path would one day be open to him too. The Lawrence S. Rockefeller Preserve has become his favorite place in the Tetons. We have walked it together well over a dozen times, and each time we have gleaned something new. A patch of columbines, a doe and her fawns, an unexpected headstone among the pines. The number of people who can walk there at the same time is limited. And as a result, the forest path to Phelps Lake remains a place of personal meditation, quiet, still, and solitary. This was Lawrence Rockefeller's intention. The Rockefellers shared their wealth and their vision. Our public lands, whether a national park or monument, wildlife refuge, forest or prairie, make each one of us land rich. It is our inheritance as citizens of a country called America. In the summer of 2014, Lawrence's youngest brother David, the last living child of John D. Rockefeller Jr., returned to the restored shores of Phelps Lake. Gone were the horse stables, the cabins, and the lodge. Wild gardens of columbines and paintbrush extended down to the lakeshore. It had been rewilded. Sitting in a wheelchair, 1 year shy of 100 years old, David Rockefeller looked out across Phelps Lake toward Death Canyon, with tears streaming down his cheeks. Thank you. The Tetons are my mother park. Not a year of my life has passed without the Tetons' jagged presence. Not one. Bedrock. I am of this place. Family is a place, and my family is located here. Those who are living and those who have passed. I am settled in the scent of sage. Mount Moran's reflection at Oxbow Bend is more than a mirror of memories. It is the joy found in river otters, a reminder that there are places in the world we can turn to for a peace unchanged. After we had been gifted by the sight of the grizzly on my father's birthday, John Tempest picked up his great-grandson, Wyatt, and held him. Did you see that big bear, little man? Later that day, Wyatt would take his first awkward steps toward the extended hands of his great-grandfather on his 80th birthday. He would not know it then, but one day he would be told that the day he learned to walk was the day he saw a grizzly standing upright in the presence of family. Four generations that will be followed by four more, and four more beyond that. This is what we can promise the future, a legacy of care, that we will be good stewards and not take too much or give back too little, that we will recognize wild nature for what it is in all its magnificent and complex history, an unfathomable wealth that should be consciously saved, not ruthlessly spent. Privilege is what we inherit by our status as Homo sapiens, living on this beautiful planet. This is the privilege of imagination. What we choose to do with our privilege as a species is up to each of us, each in our own time, each in our own way, with the gifts that are ours. Humility is born in wildness. We are not protecting grizzlies from extinction. They are protecting us from the extinction of experience as we engage with a world beyond ourselves. The very presence of a grizzly returns us to an ecology of awe. We tremble at what appears to be a dream, yet stands before us on two legs and roars. When I think about the Greater Yellowstone as the place of my childhood of the imagination, it still plays to my heart. It is still the place we go to celebrate anniversary after anniversary, birthday after birthday. And last year, Brooke and I celebrated our 40th wedding anniversary. I was saying that each time I enter a national park, I meet the miraculous. And that wedding anniversary, I have to say, feels miraculous. And we said to each other, what should we do? And both of us, in almost split second, said, Yellowstone, wolves. We went up to the Lamar Valley. Many of you have been there, I'm sure. And we rose before dawn. It must have been 5:30 or so. And we watched the mist rise above the river. There, along the horizon line, before the woods, before the lodgepoles, march up the mountain, we saw a mound. We put up our binoculars, and you could see that it was a carcass. And it was evident that it was a bison, buffalo robe, over a scaffolding of bones. There, two coyotes were eating the carrion, two bald eagles on the carcass with several ravens. We watched. Other people joined us. A park ranger appeared and told us that the day before, this particular bison, a mother bison, was in the process of giving birth. Stillborn. She was struggling. Both were going to die. Within a matter of minutes, a pack of wolves there in the Lamar Valley took her down. Quickly. Violently. Predator prey. Hardly anything was left. As we were hearing that story, we were watching the coyotes all of a sudden becoming nervous, and they fled. The eagles flew, the ravens vanished. Out of the lodgepole pines emerged a large alpha male, white wolf. The wolf entered the cavern of bones, and from our perspective, we could see the flanks. We watched this belly just rise over an hour, barely taking a breath. Bones shimmering, no longer a rib cage, but a sculpture. The wolf left, we left, thought about it all day, returned at dusk to see if we might see the wolf again. One coyote, a few ravens, bones glistening in the last light of day. And then we noticed there was a herd of bison, maybe 200 or more. And suddenly, a line of bison, seven, single line, evenly spaced, walked to the mother bison and circled her body. Twice. Tighter. Would you believe me if I told you they bowed their heads, nudged her, sniffed her, circled one more time, and then left as they came, single file, evenly spaced, save one lone bison that stayed with her. We are not the only species who lives and breathes and dreams on the planet.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features author, conservationist, and activist Terry Tempest Williams, whose latest book is The Hour of Land. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
These are the words that have been removed from the Junior Oxford Dictionary. Acorn, adder, almond, apricot, ash, beaver, beech, beetroot, bloom, bluebell, bramble, brook, boar, catkin, chestnut, clover, cowslip, crocus, cheetah, colt, cygnet, doe, drake, ferret, heron, herring, kingfisher, lark, leopard, lobster, magpie, minnow, mussel, newt, otter, ox, oyster, panther, pelican, piglet, porcupine, porpoise, raven, stork, terrapin, thrush, weasel, wren, dandelion, fungus, hazel, hazelnut, horse chestnut, lavender, melon, mint, monarch, parsnip, pasture, poppy, primrose, sycamore, tulip, violet, walnut, willow. These are the words that have been added to the Junior Oxford Dictionary. Blog, broadband, MP3 player, voicemail, attachment, database, export, chat room, bullet point, cut and paste, analog, celebrity with a capital C, vandalism, negotiate, creep, citizenship, conflict, common sense, debate, EU, brainy, boisterous, cautionary tale, bilingual, bungee jumping, committee, compulsory, cope, democratic, allergic, biodegradable, emotion, dyslexic, donate, euro, apparatus, incisor, square number, alliteration, colloquial, idiom, curriculum, classify, chronological, block graph. And when the editor was asked why those words were removed from a children's dictionary, she said, because they are no longer part of contemporary childhood. If we can remove words from a dictionary that are so alive with meaning and withhold them from our children, removing what is alive in the world becomes easy. The wild is no longer part of our vocabulary. I hear the great poet W.S. Merwin's words, "Through all of youth I was looking for you without knowing what I was looking for." Nature becomes a forgotten language. These are difficult times, transformative times, times of extreme actions, especially within our national parks. Extreme drought, extreme fires, extreme development with extreme policy shifts needed in the name of climate change. The world is changing dramatically, both ecologically as well as politically. But I believe, as you know, that the greatest transformation as a species will be spiritual. The word "we" must include all species. The religious scholar Karen Armstrong, whom I love, says, "Compassion is an act, not an emotion. But if it were an emotion, it would be most closely aligned with the word discomfort." Don't you love that? Discomfort and disturbance. Holy disturbance. Each in our own way, each in our own time, with the gifts that are ours? How might we disturb? How might we create discomfort, holy discomfort, in our acts of compassion? In my mind, it's about being awake. It's about not falling asleep or being complacent, but putting our love into action, which is how our national parks have come to be. I love when Orin Lyons, a spiritual leader of the Seneca Nation, said in a recent conversation, "It can no longer be about the color of our skin. It must be about the color of our blood. Our national parks are blood, and blood has been spilled. We have a shadowed history in our national parks, particularly with indigenous people, native people. The original history of each and every protected area is held by a native people who were there first, who call it home. What places are considered sacred?" I think about Kayleen Sisk, chief of the Winnemem Wintu tribe. She takes care of Mount Shasta. That is her job. And she says, "For us, the biggest thing is to have non-Indigenous people understand that there is a way to be there, a way of walking on the land without destroying it." This is the vision that the tribes in the Colorado Plateau are bringing forth with Bears Ears National Monument. Five tribes, Diné, the Navajo, Hopi, Zuni, and the two Ute tribes, are saying to the president, "President Obama, please protect these lands, close to 2 million acres adjacent to Canyonlands National Park, because this is our home ground, where our ceremonies are performed, where the bones of our dead are buried. It is our medicine cabinet, these plants. We know them by name." Our governor, our Congressman Rob Bishop, says that if Obama were to make this a national monument and listen to the tribes, there would be violence. The elders are saying, we must walk our prayers, not talk. At the intersection of landscape and culture, diversity and inclusion, patterns of cooperation emerge in the name of community. This could be a healing, another evolution of our vision as a nation of our national parks, even a healing between the Native people, the United States government, the National Park Service. We, the people, have made mistakes. We have made mistakes in our relationship with those who came before us and the land that holds their histories. We have made mistakes in how we have managed and misunderstood the wild. But after spending a lifetime immersed in our national parks, I have found we are slowly learning what it means to behave more respectfully and responsively to the closest thing we have as citizens to sacred lands. They are so much more than federally constructed reservations for recreation and retail. They are places of recognition where we can renew and revive our understanding of what makes us human in relationship to the life that surrounds us. When I see a mountain lion's tracks on pink sand in the desert, I am both predator and prey. When I see the elusive Everglade kite hovering above the sawgrass, I am that manifestation of hope and survival. And when I visit the Women's Rights Historical Park in Seneca Falls, New York, and listen to Sojourner Truth's speech, "Ain't I a Woman?" her voice becomes the voice I want to cultivate in the name of courage. And when we went into that sanitarium at Alcatraz, where the prisoners who were deemed insane stood, it was there that Tim DeChristopher told us what it meant when he was sent to solitary confinement for 3 weeks. It was through that open window, listening to the Hopi chants of Ai Weiwei's vision, that he began to weep, perhaps for the first time, together with friends. The miraculous. We are at a crossroads. We can continue on the path we have been on in this nation that privileges profit over people and land, or we can unite as citizens with a common cause, the health and wealth of the earth that sustains us. If we cannot commit to this kind of fundamental shift in our relationship to people and place, then democracy becomes another myth, perpetuated by those in power who care only about themselves. We have arrived at the hour of land. The time has come for acts of reverence and restraint on behalf of the earth. Cesar Chavez said, "After 30 years of organizing poor people, I have become convinced that the two greatest aspirations of humankind are equality and participation. This is what our national parks afford us. If we can learn to listen to the land and to other species, then we can begin to learn to listen to each other. This is the beginning of ceremony." I want to close with one story, and it's the last story in the book. "It is time to weep and sing," wrote W.H. Auden. At a low ebb of hope, I asked my friend Doug Peacock how he staves off despair. This is the man who kept a map of Yellowstone in the back pocket of his fatigues throughout the war, the Vietnam War, and what unfolded at night to keep insanity at bay. This is the man who so moved the writer Edward Abbey, he turned him into Hayduke of the Monkey Ranch gang. Doug said to me, "Insulate yourself with friends and seek out wild places," which is exactly what I was doing, seeking out my friend on the other side of Yellowstone on the day we learned that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had denied wolverine protection under the Endangered Species Act. While driving from Jackson Hole to Livingston, Montana, I was listening to Vivaldi's Four Seasons, recomposed by the musician Max Richter. I love this piece of music, and I love the story behind it. Richter's favorite piece of music was Vivaldi's Four Seasons. He had played it as a musician hundreds of times and had heard it even more times as a conductor. But the strangest thing started to happen. The Four Seasons had become so commercialized, so trivialized, played in elevators and as the soundtrack for cheap commercials, that he could no longer hear its beauty. It had become lost to him, demoted to musical wallpaper. Max Richter did the unthinkable. He reimagined Vivaldi's masterpiece and recomposed it so it could be heard once again at this moment in time. He added the bass notes. "The Four Seasons," he said, "is something we all carry around with us. It's everywhere. In a way, we stop being able to hear it. So the project I was interested in was about reclaiming this music for me personally. I wanted to fall in love with it all over again." Richter said, "By getting inside it and rediscovering it for myself, I was able to take a new path through a well-known landscape." I was listening to The Four Seasons recomposed as I was en route to Doug. My mind was moving toward reverie with the music. It was exactly what I needed to recompose myself as I was driving through Yellowstone to Montana. The music was inspiring me to reimagine everything, including our national parks. Our institutions and agencies are no longer working for us. Bureaucracy is replacing vision. It is time to reimagine our institutions and agencies, even the wilderness movement, as a movement of direct action. Time to reimagine our public lands as sanctuaries, refuges, and sacred lands. Time to rethink what is acceptable and what is not. I was lost in thought with the music, and then as I was driving through the Hayden Valley, the cars in front of me came to an abrupt halt. Bison jam. Hundreds of bison not only crossing the road, but walking alongside us. I was now at a crawl, barely going 5 miles per hour. I rolled down my window, still listening to The Four Seasons, with a volume much louder than I realized. The bison started moving closer to my car. I started getting nervous, thought about rolling up my window. But then the strangest thing started to occur. I noticed the bison turning their heads toward the music, walking even closer to the car. I imagined they were enjoying Vivaldi, as I was, and I relaxed as we listened to the music together for close to a mile, all of us, slowly, moving down the road. I was late to Doug's house. He was waiting. I bought him a nice French Bordeaux. We took the bottle and two glasses outside with a view of Paradise Valley. Doug had written a plea on the Wolverine's behalf a week before. It was published online in the Daily Beast. He had received a note from his editor, Chris Dickey, the son of the poet James Dickey. "I'm sorry," Chris said. "Perhaps this poem from my father will help." Under a thunderous sky with bolts of lightning adding punctuation, Doug and I read The Last Wolverine out loud to each other, between sips of wine, alternating between stanzas, with tears streaming down our cheeks. The final lines undid us. Alone, with maybe some dim racial notion of being the last, but none of how much your unnoticed going will mean, how much the timid poem needs the mindless explosion of your rage, the glutton's internal fire, the elk's heart in the belly sprouting wings, the pact of the blind swallowing thing with himself, to eat the world and not to be driven off it until it is gone, even if it takes forever. I take you as you are and make of you what I will, skunk bear, carcajoy, bloodthirsty non-survivor. Lord, let me die, but not die out. Doug and I raised our glasses to the mountains with black clouds billowing all around us as a swath of red clouds turned pink. "To Wolverine," Doug said, and he turned to me with tears in his eyes. "We lose nothing by loving." Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was author, conservationist, and activist Terry Tempest Williams, whose latest book is The Hour of Land. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.